Chapter 22. I hung a left onto Prince Road and jammed the accelerator. In order for my plan to work, I had to get in front of the grinder. I drove as quickly as I dared in the fog, looking out for flocks of birds and roaming animal monsters. The road was clear, but random obstacles popped up, like shopping carts and the occasional abandoned or wrecked car. A police car zoomed in the opposite direction, right toward me. I swerved out of the way at the last moment. The man driving the car didn't flinch as he rushed past. I only got a quick glance, but I suspected he was no real cop. I turned right, accelerating, running parallel with the monster, whose closest side was now a half mile away. The fog here was less dense, and I could see its outline as it lumbered north, still moving at about 10 miles per hour. Several animals stalked the sides of the beast, but I moved so quickly, should they attack, they couldn't catch me. As I drove, I took in the sheer size the grinder had grown to. The whole thing was at least 150 meters wide and a quarter mile long, shaped like a massive millipede. It was too big to support itself on legs, so it moved forward like a parade float, the entire base responsible for holding the rest of it up. Parts of its main bulk towered 100 meters into the sky. Tentacles waved even higher like snakes in the air. "Jesus," I whispered. Every time I saw it, it was bigger. How could I possibly find Niff in the midst of that? My heart quickened the closer I came to it. I didn't care. I had to try. I overtook the grinder until I was a good mile and a half ahead of it. Then I angled the car toward the point where we would converge. I hoped the birds and patrolling animals kept to the sides of the grinder and didn't patrol out front. Everything hinged on getting to the main mass without getting stopped. I pulled the car over, grabbed the duffel bag, and ran into the small wash on the side of the road. It smelled of sewage, and despite the warmth of my multiple layers of clothing, I shivered. 15 minutes, maybe less. That's what I had. I took a deep breath and got to work. As I pulled the hood over my head and neck seal, I thought of the days following Niff's suicide attempt. I had asked her what I could do to fix it. To fix her.
"I'm not your Rubik's Cube,"
she had said. I thought about that moment a lot. I'd never told her or anybody the story of how I'd become obsessed with the Rubik's Cube. I wondered if she knew the story, if she'd have answered the same way. I regretted not telling her now. One evening in the 6th grade, my dad gave me a Rubik's Cube. He said, "If you can solve this before morning, we'll buy you that bike you've been asking for." I had stopped asking for a bike about a year earlier. We had moved from West Virginia to a town in Georgia, a half hour south of Atlanta, and most of the kids my age didn't have bikes, so I hadn't thought much about getting one. But the lure of a new bike rekindled my interest, and I attacked that Rubik's Cube. I played with it for hours, twisting and turning, trying to figure it out. The harder I tried, the more frustrated I became. I had it made several times, except I was just one cube off. I kept getting so close. I'd think I'd have it with one or two more twists, but I would be wrong. I'd turn, and it'd be the same. Two colors would be swapped. Somewhere around 4 a.m., I realized what my father had done. I'd spent the previous 2 hours studying and recording the patterns, writing it down, and I had figured it out. He'd made the cube impossible to solve. He'd popped out a middle top square, flipped it, and put it back in, turning the puzzle into an impossible-to-solve trick. I used my Swiss Army knife to pop out the offending piece, I reversed it, and I clicked it back into place. By then, I knew my father had given it to me just to be an asshole. He wasn't going to buy me a bike. He thought it was funny, the idea of me desperately twisting that thing over and over all night. I left the completed cube in the kitchen for my father to find. That morning, he took one look at the puzzle, grabbed it off the table without a word. He walked out the door. As I watched him leave, I didn't feel clever or have the sense of triumph I thought I would. I just felt sad. Staying up all night took its toll, and I got in trouble at school that day after I passed out in the middle of my math test. At home that night, I found a huffy dirt bike sitting in the driveway. My father said nothing about it. The bike was used, had bald tires, but it was mine, and it ended up being one of my favorite possessions. I spent that night and the next teaching myself how to ride. I got pretty good at it too, and soon, other kids in the neighborhood decided they wanted bikes as well. I spent the summer after the sixth grade racing, exploring, and getting into all sorts of random trouble on the back of that thing. Even though the bike was awesome, I found myself more obsessed with the Rubik's Cube. I never again saw the one my dad had brought home, so I saved up my money and bought one myself. I practiced every night. I learned different methods for solving it, including a few of my own. By the time I started the seventh grade, I had a new trick to impress the other kids at school. The cube helped me. I felt calm, capable, solving it in just a minute or two. I always had one close to me. There was something comforting in having the ability to turn a jumbled cube into a perfect six-colored square. No matter how I found it, I could put it back to the way it was supposed to be. I discovered something that night after my dad gave me that first cube. There's no such thing as an impossible puzzle. You can have missing pieces, you can be completely over your head, but there is always an answer. You may have to cheat to get there. You may have to sacrifice more than you're willing to give, but there is always a way. I believed that with all of my heart. I took out the jar containing the pink, brain-like neural junction Clementine had extracted from the corpse, and I poured it into the fanny pack. It slopped in like a glass of milk that had been sitting out for a couple of days, and it smelled even worse. I had to hold back my gag reflex. I zipped it closed and tied the whole thing around my waist. This idea sucks, I'd said when Clementine suggested it.
I know it does, but it's all I have.
We talked about the zombie caterpillars that had so intrigued Royce and Randy, but Clementine thought the grinder was more like an ant colony or a hive.
From what I've seen, it looks like the people that are physically attached to the main body have no autonomous control. Their brains are shut off or put into sleep mode. It's only when they detach do they work semi-independently, which means it might be possible to trick the mindless workers into thinking that you are one of them. Though I wouldn't try this with any of the grinder's minions who are moving around on their own.
But how can I do that? This thing isn't stupid. It's not a bug.
You're right. And it seems very aware of its surroundings, but it's also gotten so big, with so many pieces, part of it has to work automatically. Just like you breathe, you pump blood, you grow, you fight infection, all without a single thought, this thing most certainly does not have full control over every aspect of its condition. You're small enough, it's possible you could go unnoticed, like a mosquito on a horse's hide.
She told me of another bug. A butterfly called the Mountain Alcon Blue from Eastern Europe. It didn't want to be bothered raising its own pupae. Instead, it tricked entire colonies of ants into raising them for it. It did this by making their little butterfly babies smell like they were just another ant. Not only did the pupae get raised and fed and protected by the ants, but the babies also got first-class treatment because they mimicked the sound of the queen. My plan was to make the ant colony think I was an ant, when I was really a butterfly. The neural junction tied around my waist and leaking all over my crotch was the key. I'd smell like them, and if they probed, they'd hopefully find the junction, or sense it, and leave me alone. I'd have every square inch of my body covered in a non-porous fabric that, in theory, would shield me from getting attached by touch, so the probing neurons of the beast wouldn't be able to capture me into their network. At best, they would ignore me, which would give me free rein to crawl into the grinder and seek out Niff. Clementine was certain the larger the grinder became, the more the interior would be like an ant colony with tunnels and throughways, all built and strengthened by bodies and the sinewy tendrils of the grinder's fast-growing nerves. I wasn't so sure. To me, it seemed as if the people within were stacked like fish at the meat market, no space between one body to the next. If that was the case, then I'd have to crawl about the exterior and hope I'd find a way in. And if I didn't, I'd start digging. Once I found Niff, I would implement the second part of the plan, getting her out. I tightened the gas mask. I pulled the straps on the back to make a snug fit. Then I pulled the syringes from the duffel bag and duct taped around my arms and legs. I slung the entire bag over my shoulder. After a moment of second guessing, I decided to switch out my shoes. I took them off, pulled on the waterproof socks, and tied on the dive boots with the cleats. I pulled on the gloves. The gas mask was surprisingly comfortable, despite the throbbing pain of my multiple head injuries. It wasn't like the gas mask from the 40s with the twin eye holes, but it featured a single, tinted screen that covered the entirety of my face, giving me a wide view. Dual respirator canisters hung at my neck. I feared the tug at my chest would grow as I neared the grinder, but it didn't. I still felt it, ever present, but its intensity still hadn't changed. It was in those idle moments, I realized, that I felt it the most, when the adrenaline pumped especially hard. When I fixated on something else, it abated. The devil catches you when you're sleeping, my mother used to say. I could hear it before I saw it, like a constant roll of distant thunder, not quite so loud as you'd think given its size, but loud enough to shake rocks and gravel on the ground. It materialized from the fog like a tidal wave of death, a mountain emerging from behind the curtain.
You're an idiot, you know that, right?
I said out loud. I couldn't hear my own voice. Several large shapes marched in front of the beast. I slipped back down into the wash and peered through the weeds. A pair of Hummers led the procession, smashing through cars as they passed. A soldier in full gear manned the mounted machine gun on the right. At first I thought no one stood behind the gun on the left, but then I saw the small head. It barely rose above the sight. Jeez, it was just a young girl, no older than 6 or 7. Clutched onto the mounted weapon. As jarring as it was to see her, I barely had time to register the sight before my eyes focused on the menagerie that ambled between the grinder and the two Hummers. Mini grinders, at least 15 of them, lumbered along, all of them bigger than the cats from earlier. They ranged in size from about 8 feet tall to a couple huge ones almost as large as the grinder when it invaded Arizona Stadium. Only, they were different. Different even from the cats. It took me a moment to realize in what way. The real grinder was made of people and animals, its exterior uneven and ever-changing. Even when it had been smaller, each incarnation looked like a hastily put-together Lego sculpture with arms hanging out the side, no true continuity, and a perpetual sense that it could change again at any moment. These mini-grinders, however, formed very specific shapes. Unchanging shapes from the looks of it. Their exteriors were more like a quilt than a Lego sculpture. It didn't look as if they were made to break apart and come together again either. The bodies were fused with no space between them, formed to make horrific creatures whose only imaginable purpose was to instill fear before they destroyed. Before I'd lost the radio, I'd heard the word chimera, the mythical creature made from parts of a lion, a goat, and a snake. I think that's a close but not perfect way to describe these new monsters who marched dumbly down the avenue toward my position. These were more like Frankenstein's monster, or golems made of flesh. Two of them resembled massive scorpions with sharpened metal infused into the meat of their tails. Their bodies were a patchwork of naked human flesh. Towering behind was a 25-foot-tall gorilla-like beast made of coyote. Two giant, octopus-like balls appeared, caked in nothing but charred flesh, giving them the appearance of a hardened shell. But mostly, I gaped at the middle of the parade, at the pink crab thing, made out of babies. It stood out more than any of the others, its pink, bulbous body, made entirely of infants, skittered sideways as it moved along. The sight of it caused a fear and revulsion within me that I hadn't expected. After all I'd seen, the infants' heads all stuck outward, like the crab was covered with hairy pimples. And unlike the other flesh golems, these infants all appeared alive and aware. Every single one of them screamed at the top of their lungs. The sound carried high in the air, louder and louder as the parade approached. Like the grinder, none of these monsters had eyes or discernible heads, and I wondered just how autonomous they were. I had to avoid notice. If the golems or any other drones or animals in the grinder's posse spied me, surely they would rip me to shreds or just remove my mask and stick me face first into the network. I sank deeper into the muck at the bottom of the wash, and I readied myself to jump up onto the grinder as it approached. My heart beat so hard, it felt as if it kicked the inside of my chest. I wondered if there was a God, if there was a heaven, if this act would be considered suicide. How could it not? Only twice in my life had I ever considered suicide, and both times were when I waited desperately in a hospital waiting room. After Nif's overdose, and after her suicide attempt, in those dark moments when I thought she wouldn't make it. When I tried to envision a sunrise in a world without her, I knew it would be too unbearable. The Hummers passed on the street to my right. Their loud diesel engines roared. To my left, one of the flesh scorpions crashed by, and I cringed as I heard the sound of Zora's car crushed under its weight. Glass rained on me. I kept low, praying they wouldn't look down. Crash! A leg made of screaming babies plunged into the wash, just inches from me. Water and mud splashed over me in the visor, and I instinctively rubbed it off. The leg was the diameter of a barrel, and the tip was made of metal that fused up into the flesh. I stared in horror at the babies who faced me, but their eyes were all clenched closed. With a sickening feeling, I realized most, if not all, were dead, and their cries were really post-mortem puppetry designed to make any attackers piss in their pants. The leg paused, as if it sensed someone was near. I held my breath. All the eyes of the babies snapped open. I didn't move. I huddled in the shadow, doing my best to hide and keep from screaming. I knew young babies had limited eyesight, but I didn't know how limited. The eyes closed, and the monster continued on its way. "I'm coming, Nif. I'm doing my best." The massive, round golems rolled over the road, and one passed directly over the ridge in which I hid. The asphalt at the edge cracked and crumbled, but it held. That was the last in the line. I only had a few seconds to act. Am I being brave or stupid? I sprang up from the wash and scrambled up the side. I turned to face the grinder.